watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. God Bless America billboards are sprouting across the landscape, and corporate chain store marquees advertise their pride in being American. Yet those very chain stores pay their employees so badly that many must work two full-time jobs in order to just make ends meet, while they reap enormous profits selling goods made abroad under slave labor conditions. Opinion makers are consciously trying to create an American unity that does not exist, the plethora of United We Stand banners notwithstanding. Ours is a society in which an unacknowledged war is already raging. It is the war against the poor by the rich. Tonight's program will look at the fight of millions of working people to merely meet their basic economic needs, as the government, in partnership with corporate America, uses its might and our resources to transfer greater quantities of the national wealth into fewer hands. In the first hour, a union leader will speak about the role of the trade union movement in the fight for a living wage. In the second hour, faith-based groups in our community join the fight for economic justice, and public housing residents fight the federal government. Last, a Canadian activist will take a look at the anti-globalization movement in the wake of the September 11th suicide bombings.
I don't know, good horse. We trot in this dark here, robbing the rich is for worse or for best. They take it by stealing and lying and gambling, and I take it my way, my shiny black vest.
Bruce Rayner is president of Unite, the Union of Needlework, Industrial, and Textile Employees. He's also on the Board of Trustees of Cornell University. He spoke to students and faculty at the School of Industrial Labor Relations at Cornell on August 30th.
I graduated from this school I went to this school in 1968 to 1972, and I've had a special attachment to it ever since. When I attended here, things were a little bit different. We didn't have that beautiful new building that has been constructed and all those great facilities. But the other thing was, there was, on the positive side, there was a tremendous spirit of activism on the campus. The students were idealistic. There's a lot of questioning of what's right and what's wrong with society. There was a tremendous amount of debate and discussion that took place in classes, in the coffee shops, in the bars. I think back then we had 18 drinking age. I think now it's a little bit higher. So I know none of you drink. But we did back then. And there was a lot of debates that took place about what's right with society, what's wrong with society, and it was a tremendously exciting time to be on campus. It's beginning to feel that way again, and I encourage students to participate. This is a wonderful education. It's a wonderful school. Ask a lot of questions. Fight for your point of view, and use this opportunity to try to answer some questions about your future and about the future of our country. This is a Labor Day event. I also have another special reason for being here, which is I'm still amazed, but my daughter is a freshman at the ILR school this year, which is an absolutely amazing event to me, and that's another reason for me to enjoy being up here today. This is a Labor Day event, but I'm not going to talk about Labor Day. I'll leave that to the labor historians. You can ask Cletus and the others as to how Labor Day began. I want to talk about what's going on in the country now. I know more about that than I do about how Labor Day began. The fact is that we live in an amazing time, and you live in you're going to college in an amazing time in history, this country. America has achieved worldwide dominance economically. American economy rules the world. Europe is a distant second. Asia is in disrepair. The American economy rules the world. The American economic model has become the model for the world. The former communist regimes can't wait to mimic American capitalism. American military power is, for the first time in history, totally unchallenged. I don't know if you have to go back as far as the Roman Empire to find where one country so dominated the world militarily as American military might does today. And even culturally, as sick as it is, our NBA stars and our singers and our Hollywood movies are known throughout the world. People who can't speak our language can identify our stars and our basketball players and our football players and our actors and singers. America dominates the world culturally, economically, and militarily. And we've also seen, despite the current round of a recession taking place, and I guess the economists haven't called it a recession yet, but it is, trust me, there's a recession going on out there in the world. But despite this minor interruption, the American economy has had unprecedented growth and accumulation of wealth, unbelievable and unknown in the history of the world. And what has that done? Well, we've also seen, as the accumulation of tremendous wealth and this worldwide dominance taking place, the total disintegration of the American middle class and the concentration of wealth in the hands of the few in our society, unlike in the history of this country. When I graduated from the school in 1972, and you will graduate, those who graduate this year and the next 4 years, you'll graduate into a country where the wealth has been accumulated by a few people at the top of our society in incredible ways. The top 1% of the American population has the same income as the bottom 100 million. Just put those two statistics next to you. The top 1% of our population. And in a way, it's not only income, it's also wealth. The top 1% own 38% of all the wealth in America. The bottom 90% own less than the top 1%. We've got worldwide, the situation is even worse. The three richest individuals in the world, if you add up their wealth, it's equal to the gross domestic product of the 48 poorest countries on the earth. The accumulation of wealth in the hands of the few is a phenomenon, and it's continuing unabated, that we've never seen before. Of the 100 largest economic entities in the world, 51 of them are companies and 49 of them are countries. If you take the 100 largest economic entities, beginning with the United States of America, and you put them in a chart, 51 of them are corporations. We've got a giant five and dime called Walmart, whose sales last year were $191 billion, which is larger than the gross domestic product of Greece, which is twice the gross domestic product of Ireland. One company, a worldwide retail chain with absolutely enormous power. General Electric, and I'll talk more about the criminal that runs that company in a few minutes. General Electric is larger than Colombia. That means every man, woman, and child, the government of Colombia, the natural resources, the forest, add it all together, and General Electric is wealthier than Colombia. And we've seen an acceptance of CEO pay that is absolutely immoral, illogical, and doesn't make any sense to any fair-thinking individual. And we've seen CEO pay not tied to how well the wealth of that corporation is distributed amongst the people that create the wealth, the workers, the managers, even their customers, but wealth concentrated in the hands of the CEOs at the top of the company. We got an example like Coca-Cola. I spent 20 years of my life in Atlanta. Coca-Cola runs Atlanta. And Coca-Cola CEO, a guy named Douglas Daft, paid himself $91,681,000 last year, but he did a good job. He laid off 6,000 workers in the year 2000, 6,000 men and women who deliver Coca-Cola, who put the drink in the bottles, who work in the factories, who work as managers and secretaries and clericals, 6,000 laid off and gave himself a 150% increase in pay. Then let's talk about something closer to hand than Atlanta. Let's talk about upstate New York. If you want to see the effect of General Electric in upstate New York, take a weekend trip to Schenectady and see what's happened to one of the to a fine American community, once the home of 25,000 General Electric workers. Schenectady is now a town in economic decline. The schools are bad. There's social problems. There's high unemployment. General Electric, headed by a guy named Jack Welch, who amazingly paid himself $231 million last year, plus $57 million in unexercised stock options for a grand total of $288 million. Jack Welch's main achievement in running General Electric is to shift jobs from Schenectady, New York, and communities across the country, good-paying union jobs, jobs that workers could make a living, support their families, send their kids to college, shut those plants down. There are now 45,000 General Electric workers in Latin America, 30,000 in Mexico, none of them making a living, none of them achieving any kind of the rewarding part of society that the General Electric workers who were left behind. The communities that built that company, led by Schenectady, but all across America, have been abandoned as General Electric left and carried the jobs with it down to third world countries in Latin America and is exploiting the workers in that country. And Jack Welch, amazingly enough, comes up in surveys as one of the most admired Americans. Jack Welch has destroyed the lives of thousands and thousands of American families. Jack Welch has not, because the company needed to do it, but in order to achieve enormous profits, in order to pay himself money that he can't possibly spend in his lifetime, Jack Welch has ruined the lives of thousands of American families. Jack Welch is a criminal. I believe Jack Welch belongs in a federal prison. If one of us ruined the lives of one American family by robbing a house, you see how quick you get locked up. Don't try it in Ithaca. Jack Welch has destroyed much of what that company, of what created the giant of General Electric. And yet, Jack Welch comes up in surveys as one of the most admired Americans. It's absolutely a sick concept in this country. We've come to worship at the altar of money. Let me give you a quote from this great man. Jack Welch, when asked recently about location of jobs, he said, quote, "Ideally, you'd have every plant on a barge to move with currencies and changes in the economy." This is a man who has no regard for human beings, has no regard for equity, has no regard for fairness. And let's take another company that's near and dear to your hearts, American Online. Most of us have that. It's great. American Online is part of Time Warner. Gerald Levin, and he had a decent year last year. He paid himself $163,817,000, and he laid off 3,000 workers in January of 2000, and then decided in order to boost their stock price, they needed to lay off another 2,400 workers, despite the company having record profits. We've got the creation of a guy, this character who runs Microsoft, Bill Gates. Bill Gates now is worth $63 billion. Just to put that in perspective, because I think these billions are not reality to most of us, Jack Welch is personally worth as much as the entire 26 million people of Peru put together. The entire country of Peru, 26 million people. Bill Gates gives away a couple of million dollars and we make him a hero. Bill Gates doesn't need that money. Bill Gates has not shared that money with the people that built Microsoft. Bill Gates is not to be admired, in my opinion. Bill Gates is to be despised. We've seen companies also close at hand. How about let's take a friendly name on Wall Street, Goldman Sachs. In 1999, the 220 partners of Goldman Sachs took that company public. And they split up the tidy sum of $16 million, which is about equal to what the 35 million people who live in Tanzania live on for an entire year. 35 million children, 35 million adults, entire population of Tanzania. 221 Goldman Sachs Wall Street executives split up the same amount of money. And what effect has this concentration of wealth had on this country? Well, let me tell you the effect it's had. It's been devastating on most of our population. Good jobs have gone away and are continuing to go away by the thousands, and lousy jobs are in their place. When I graduated from this school, the largest employer in America was General Motors. Today, the largest employer in America is Walmart. General Motors employed 750,000 Americans, good auto jobs. Those workers made a living. They sent their kids to college. They bought homes. They bought cars. They bought washing machines. They lived a bit of the American dream. Walmart, 800,000 employees, 60% of whom have no health insurance because Walmart sets the hours, 32 hours a week, to get health insurance at Walmart. And then they schedule 60% of their workforce less than that so they don't qualify for health insurance. What happens? The government and the general public are responsible, if there is responsibility, for the health care of those 480,000 employees of Walmart. Walmart is the biggest welfare cheat in America. It's a company that lives by cheating the people that work for it. It also has a tremendously negative effect on the people that make the products for that company. And it's a sad state of America when General Motors is replaced by Walmart, which it is. We've seen by ill-conceived trade laws, jobs shipped out by the thousands in manufacturing, jobs that provided people with a high school education, because contrary to what ex-President Bill Clinton said repeatedly, every American is not cut out to go to college. Every American culturally, intellectually, and opportunity-wise is not going to go to college. In fact, a large portion of our population is not going to. Manufacturing jobs provided a way for those people to enter the middle class, to have a piece of the American dream. Our government policies under Democrats and Republicans, beginning with NAFTA, have shifted those jobs out of this country and replaced them with lousy jobs. Let me talk about what they said. In 1995, when we lost the vote in Congress on the North American Free Trade Agreement, they said it would not hurt American manufacturing. Obviously, they were lying. Hundreds of thousands of jobs left. They said it would help Mexican workers. What's happened since 1995 in 6 years? The real wages of Mexican workers are lower today than when NAFTA passed. And then we have this Coca-Cola idiot running Mexico now, Vicente Fox, who said at the beginning of the year when he took office he was going to create millions of jobs for Mexicans. Mexican unemployment is 20%. Mexican workers are voting with their feet, defying U.S. border guards and adverse conditions, walking through deserts, climbing over barbed wire fences to come to this country because of the devastating poverty in that country. And contrary to Fox's claim that it would create jobs, since Fox became president of Mexico, there's been 600,000 jobs lost in the economy of Mexico. NAFTA hasn't helped Mexico, and NAFTA has been devastating on the industrial base in this country. And now we've got President Bush asking for authority to extend free trade agreements, further reducing the industrial base in this country. We've had politicians from both political parties betray working people. We've got a country that, sadly enough to say, I think you can judge a country morally by how it treats its young and how it treats its elderly. And let's judge America. 25% of the children in this country today live in poverty. One out of every four American children live in poverty. That is a national disgrace, and the politicians responsible for it ought to pay for it. And our elderly, we've set Social Security on a path where now with Bush's tax cut, it's likely going to be in a funding crisis, even if they don't pass that stupid plan with 401ks for poor people. Social Security doesn't allow people to retire early enough. You know, if you're a corporate executive, you can retire at 68, 69. You haven't worked hard. Try being a hotel maid or a janitor or a garment worker. At 65, you're plenty tired, and you're ready to retire, and you deserve to retire. They've raised the age of Social Security, and Social Security is no longer enough to live on. America, despite its wealth, can't seem to figure out how it treats its young and how it treats its old. We've got 44 million Americans today have no access to health care. 44 million Americans have to make a decision whether to take their child to the doctor or whether to put groceries on the table or pay their rent to put gasoline in their car. The fact of the matter is that American health care system is a national disgrace. If you're rich in this country, if you've got good insurance, you get top-notch health care. If you're poor in this country, your health care is slipshod or non-existent. American poor people and American working people don't get the same health care as American executives. And health care and access to medicines and procedures should be a matter of right, not a matter of how wealthy you are. We've seen a country that watches a power crisis in California. I love the power crisis in California. They have brownouts. I know that there's probably professors who could explain it much more eloquently than I can, but let me, I think, define the power crisis in California for you, from my point of view. In 1999, all the people of California paid $7 billion for electric power. In the year 2000, they paid $27 billion for electric power in California. And in the year 2001, they will pay $40 billion for electric power in the state of California. The fact is, the only crisis is Enron and Duke Power and those corporations have decided they want to make enormous profits off the citizens of California. And the power crisis is generated as a crisis for the people that have to pay the bills, not the corporations that are profiting from the electrical, so-called electrical power crisis. When I graduated from this school, we had just come through the Vietnam War movement. We had just come through the civil rights movement. And many of us thought with the assassination of Martin Luther King in 1968, many of us thought with the passage of the Civil Rights Act that civil rights had finally become a reality and accepted in American society. Well, folks, our society has not accepted civil rights. Our society, race is a tougher issue in our society today, in my opinion, than it was when I graduated from this school. 12.3% of the American population is black. Over 50% of the prisoners in America are black. If you're a black male aged 20 to 29, you have a 30% chance of being in prison, on parole, or on probation. 30% of the black young men in this country between the age of 20 to 29 are either in prison, on parole, or on probation. This is a country that's decided to build prisons instead of put their money into schools, that's decided to put people in prison instead of putting money into Head Start and good public schools and making university education available for them. And yet we've got corporate executives that continue the drive to push down the living standards of Americans. Let me quote another great American, Stanley Mihalik, who's a vice president of Goodyear. And I purposely have quoted only people who did not graduate from the ILR school. He said, until we get real wage levels down closer to those of Brazil and Korea, we cannot pass along productivity gains to workers and be competitive. The fact is that they are lowering the living standards of American workers in a systematic way, and it's changing the whole nature and character of this country. And it's a dangerous thing. It's a thing that it's a problem that this generation that's sitting in the room can and needs to confront. Now, there are people that believe in political solutions. Well, the fact of the matter is, while the Republican Party is clearly dominated by corporate America, the Democratic Party is heavily influenced by corporate America. Better, but hardly a solution to challenging the incredible power of this country. We have a president now who you can say several things about. He, in all the presidents in my lifetime, he is certainly the dumbest. He wouldn't pass Dean Lawler in the ILR school. He wouldn't make it through the first semester. Because he also has another endearing quality, which is extremely lazy. He's a guy who got born on third base and thought he hit a triple. But the fact of the matter is, as much as we can get a laugh off of this guy, and we can, he's also extremely dishonest and extremely dangerous. He happens to be the leader of the world's political leader. He's responsible. He will be responsible, I believe, for ruining the environment if he gets an opportunity to do it. He has rolled back ergonomic standards which will affect thousands and hundreds of thousands of American workers who are injured on the job every day. He rolled it back in his first few days in office. He's a man who is going to continue the corporate control of society and expand it if he possibly can. He's appointed a Treasury Secretary, Paul O'Neill, who says, I quote, "I think it's really corrosive to have this argument about the rich and the poor. It's not worthy of where we are in the development of this country to talk about such matters." He's the U.S. Treasury Secretary. But the fact is that as evil as this man is and what his wishes are for the working people and the majority of America, we've also got the Democratic Party, where we saw President Bill Clinton pass NAFTA, where we saw Democrats, moderated to be sure, but also moving on the corporate agenda of control of this country in the hands of the few that have the wealth. You know, it always amazes me. I'm proud to say I've got five children. And if somebody would try to harm one of my kids, and some of you in this audience have children, if somebody would try to harm one of my kids, I wouldn't pass out a leaflet or sign a petition. I'd knock the hell out of them. And yet, they are harming the opportunities and the lives of the young people of this country every day. And it's time something was done about it other than passing a petition and voting. The fact of the matter is politics are not going to solve those problems. The only force in society that has the independence, the power, and the capability, and the courage to stand up to this domination of society, which sounds discouraging, yet true, is the organized labor movement. As imperfect as it is, the labor movement is the only force with the power to do something about it. And does the labor movement make a difference in America? You bet it does. You want to find out whether the labor movement makes a difference? Ask a hotel maid in the city of New York. A hotel maid in the city of Dallas, one of America's premier cities, makes $5.50 an hour, has no health insurance, is treated any way a supervisor wants to treat him, and works the amount of hours that supervisor says when that supervisor says it. A hotel maid in the city of New York at the end of the current contract the hotel restaurant workers have will make $20 an hour cleaning up rooms in the city of New York, has health care, has a retirement plan, is treated with dignity and respect the way you would want someone to be treated, a member of your family who had that job. The fact of the matter is that the labor movement makes a difference, a dramatic difference to workers every day. In the city of New York, there are 50,000 garment workers. 50,000 garment workers today in the city of New York. 25,000 of them are members of Unite, my union. Not a single non-union garment worker in the city of New York has health care. Not one. Not a single non-union worker has a retirement. Not a single non-union worker gets a paid holiday. Not a single paid holiday. Whatever the problems in the garment industry in New York, the only workers that are treated with any dignity and respect, the only workers with benefits, happen to be the half of them that are in unions. When I graduated from this school, 90% of the garment workers in the city of New York were in unions. We've seen the proliferation of sweatshops in Brooklyn, the Bronx, that didn't exist 20 years ago. I'll talk more about that. We've got weak labor laws that have allowed employers to crush workers at will in the labor law courses. You'll hear about what the laws are supposed to do. You'll also hear about what they don't accomplish, if they haven't heard already. But the labor movement and my union and many of us understand one thing, that the way we get power to do something about the corporate domination of this society and what it's doing to American culture and the way of life in this country is we get power only one way, and that's through organization. And American unions, beginning in 1995 with the resurgence of leadership at the AFL-CIO under John Sweeney and Rich Trumka, have begun the tough task of fighting our way back against this tremendous onslaught with some major degree of success. We've seen the wages and benefits of janitors from one end of the United States to the other because of the heroic efforts of the Service Employees Union be raised considerably. We've seen Los Angeles janitors 4 years ago clubbed by a bunch of L.A. cops when they tried to protest against conditions. And then last year, we saw those same janitors march through Los Angeles with the support of the public, the press, and achieve a $2 wage increase. which for people that earn $7 an hour is the difference between surviving and getting a little bit of happiness and getting none at all. And we've seen that dramatic change in a few short years. We've seen a city like Las Vegas, known for casinos, gambling, and gangsters, become America's best union town. 50,000 members of the hotel restaurant workers are now members of the labor movement. The wages and benefits of Las Vegas hotel workers and casino workers are the best in the country. We've seen unions rise against powers greater than we have and yet prevail anyway. My union, founded by Jewish and Italian immigrants, continues to be a union that fights on behalf of low-wage and immigrant workers. And we fight against opponents that are larger, we fight against companies that are richer, and we fight on behalf of workers that don't have power. And let me share a couple of those with you. Earlier, actually last year, the end of last year, 750 workers that work for a company called Royal Airline Laundry in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Miami, Dallas, decided that they wanted to get a union. These are workers making $5.50 an hour, no health insurance, no sick days. You know what? Laundry workers do some of the hardest, dirtiest work in the American economy. And these workers did laundry for the airlines. All the laundries are located near the airports. And these workers, mostly undocumented, Latino immigrants, when the workers started to sign union cards, the employer threatened to have them deported, scared them to death. The workers could not win that fight by traditional labor organizing. But our union doesn't necessarily use traditional labor organizing. And we launched a campaign on behalf of those workers to force that employer who said he would never sign a union contract. A nice employer from Long Island. Some of you could relate to that. And on the Monday before Thanksgiving, the busiest travel day of the year, these workers could not organize the union on their own, but they could organize the union because they're part of Unite. The busiest travel day of the year, we held press conferences in 20 airports across the country. The press conferences were a public service because we discovered from these Latino laundry workers that the blankets on the airplanes are often, if they don't look dirty, you think that they're wrapped in plastic. That means that they were cleaned and washed. Well, what happens is oftentimes the company, because they want to save money, if it doesn't look dirty, they fold the blanket up and then they wrap it in plastic again. And so that blanket has never been cleaned. So you're sharing with the passengers that went before you, sharing germs, sharing. And so we had those blankets analyzed by a lab. And we discovered some of the sexiest diseases and germs that you would ever imagine. And we thought that the American traveling public on this particular day needed to know what they were going to snuggle up against as they got on the airplanes with mom and dad and the kids to travel. And so we held a press conference along with our friends from the airline pilots and the flight attendants and the hotel workers that prepare the food for the airlines. And we said that the American public had a right to know, and we had the lab reports. And we held that in Ronald Reagan Airport in Washington, D.C. We thought that that guy would appreciate it. And we had coverage all across the country. And, of course, the next day we got sued by United and American because those are the two airlines that we particularly – and we expected to get sued by them. We think it's good that their lawyers get a little work. But the chaos that was caused as we spread the message about the dirty blankets – and then we discovered the next thing is those little earphones you stick in your ears – you think those little things have been cleaned if it's wrapped in plastic, right? Well, the workers who do that work say if it's not visibly dirty, they just put it in the wrap machine and you're sharing the earphones with your friends who flew on the flights before. And we thought that people needed to know that, not because we had anything against this company, but just as a public service because unions have an obligation. So we held press conferences about that, and we held demonstrations in airports. And the laundry still refused to recognize the union. In fact, the head of the company, a guy named Sherwin Glaubman, said that the union used dishonest tactics and that I was a gangster, which really hurt my feelings. He said that on television. And we continued the campaign on behalf of the workers, and the company continued to fire these workers, continued to terrorize them, actually went to the INS, which is the capital punishment for an immigrant from Nicaragua, went to the INS to have four Nicaraguan workers deported from the facility in New York. And we continued the pressure on this company. And then we decided that it was not enough to continue with the public campaign, that we thought individual passengers ought to be able to identify individual germs. So we created a kit, and the kit had in it a test tube, a cotton swab, a mailer, a little thing where you mail it back, and so we would pay for the postage. And basically, you could take your own germ sample. So you'd get your blanket on the plane, you take the cotton swab, rub it on the blanket, stick it in the test tube, put it in the mailer, and it would go to a laboratory in Columbus, and then the lab would give you your personal assortment of what diseases were on your particular blanket, and the union would get a copy of that. And we handed them out. We started in Chicago. And no one told us in Chicago that you have to get permits to hand these things out at the airport. We just assumed it was a public place. So we went to all the planes, and we handed it as the people got on the planes. Well, United, which can't get a flight off on time anyway, stopped the plane to get these kits back from the passengers. Well, you know, most of the passengers in these planes, a lot of them are corporate executives, you know, and, you know, a lot of us are used to being shoved around and having fights with these people in authority. But, you know, these corporate lawyer types, they're not used to that. Everybody listens to them. So they were told, give me that. And, of course, several of the lawyers refused to give it to them. United refused to have the plane take off. United got sued by three different guys in Chicago for taking their personal property away from them. And then United came to us and said, look, what will it take to stop this? We said, you forced that guy to sign a union contract. And they said, okay. And within a period of weeks, negotiations took place, and all 750 of those workers not only got a 75-cent-an-hour pay increase, they got health insurance, they got sick days, they got a retirement, they got dignity and respect, and they got it signed up in a union contract within weeks of the meeting with United. Another laundry battle took place in the great city of Baltimore a few weeks ago. The city of Baltimore, all the laundries in that city are non-union. Now, you want to know what a hard job is in America? It's working in a laundry that washes linens from hospitals. Just think about the sheets. Just think about the towels that come from hospitals, the needles, the diseases, the danger. One of the demands in laundry contracts, one of the outrageous union demands, is the right to a tetanus shot provided by the employer because of the diseases workers get from washing laundry. Unpleasant, dirty work, low-paid work. Not a single laundry in the city of Baltimore's union. Up-to-date laundry, the largest laundry in the city, we decided to organize. We had a union election at Up-to-Date. Up-to-Date is half black workers, half Latino workers. The company fired 32 black workers who were the leaders of the union campaign 5 days before the election because they thought we would win. They rolled up a truck of horse manure and put it in the driveway so that the workers leafleting the plant would have to stand in horse manure if they wanted to give out union leaflets. The sick characters that ran that company. And despite the firings, despite everything they did, we lost that election by 7 votes out of 270 workers. And we went dutifully to the National Labor Relations Board, and they set that election aside, and they ordered the company to reinstate the workers. And our lawyer called me from the hearing room and said, Bruce, I don't like the way the guy sounds because they're going to reinstate the workers, but he's smiling and he's cocky, and they must have something up their sleeve. And sure enough, they reinstated the 32 workers, and then the boss called all the workers together, the Latino and black workers, and he lined up the 10 most vocal union supporters, said, stand in the front of the room. The government just ordered me to put these people back to work. And he said, I quote, these niggers are out of here. And 10 black workers were escorted out of that plant by security guards. We decided that this sick individual and this oppression of people was not going to be fought in traditional ways. And we knew that if we called a strike, if we took those workers to a strike vote, that only half the workers would go out because the workers were scared, undocumented, poor people. And we decided to strike anyway. We struck for recognition. Those workers could not win that fight because only half of them went out. The boss was anxious. He was happy that we struck. Well, we began a campaign against his customers to force him to give union recognition. And the first one was a beautiful downtown Sheraton Hotel in Baltimore. And those of you know Baltimore, it's a beautiful hotel. And this hotel had just been remodeled. And they had put this gorgeous beige carpeting. We represent textile workers, so there's special mills that make made-to-order carpeting. It's very expensive. And they made this beautiful beige carpet. So we decided this was a non-union hotel, that we needed to have a demonstration at that hotel. And so we brought 200 workers, and we had a sit-in in the lobby of the Sheraton in Baltimore. And unbelievably, but despite our best efforts, a lot of our people had evidently walked through tar on the way from the union hall to the demonstration. Now, you know, that could happen to anybody. And unfortunately, it happened, and that's really tough on carpets, especially that new one. And after that demonstration, after the police escorted us out and arrested a couple of people, the general manager of the Sheraton called and said, "We will not do business with that laundry till the strike is settled." We said, "Look, if that's your moral judgment, we agree with it. We appreciate that. And we will not have any more sit-ins in your hotel." But that was not enough. And we approached Kwaizi Mfume, who's the president of the NAACP, whose headquarters is in Baltimore. We made our case to Mfume about the conditions these workers work under, the disrespect, the racial overtones of the campaign. The Maryland Commission on Human Rights quoted the boss as saying the term nigger is acceptable shop talk, and he's allowed to use it and does use it, and says everyone knows we're only kidding. And the Latino workers were told that they can't speak English, they're not entitled to instructions, they just have to do what they're told or he'll call the INS on them. And so when Mfume heard what he had to say, he came to us and said, "It sounds pretty preposterous, I'm going to get the other side." And I knew this owner would come through for us. And I said, "Please, Mr. Mfume, get the other side." So he called up the owner and said, "Look, the union's made all these allegations. Before the NAACP gets involved, I want to find out, is it true that you think that it's acceptable to call the black workers who work at that plant niggers?" And the owner said, "Well, yeah, but, you know, it's just shop talk." This is to the president of the NAACP. The guy's not the smartest, you know, he's not the brightest bulb in the light. And Mfume asked him about health care for their children. And the owner said, "You know these people, they just keep having kids. You can't, no one could afford health care for their children." And Mfume came back and said, "This man is a sick individual. And not only will I help you, I want to hold a press conference on the gate of that laundry." And he did. He brought all the black ministers from Baltimore to the press conference on the gates. And we launched a campaign. And Mfume asked us, "Who's the biggest customer of this laundry after the Sheraton Hotel?" And we said, "It's a very prestigious educational institution called John Hopkins University Medical Center." And Mfume said, "You know what?" Which, of course, we knew. He said, "I'm on the board of trustees of John Hopkins University." And he said, "I think that I'm going to exercise a provision in the board of trustees that requires a special meeting of the trustees if called by a certain number of trustees." And he got a few of his friends on the board. And a special meeting of the board of trustees of John Hopkins was called to order. And Mfume made an impassioned speech. He brought in two of the workers from the plant, one black and one Latino. And John Hopkins trustees voted to cease to do business with that laundry till the strike was settled that Monday. And that still didn't break the back of this miserable employer. And so we went after the University of Maryland Medical Center, held a demonstration with 1,000 workers in front of the University of Maryland. We embarrassed Kathy Kennedy Townsend, who's the lieutenant governor, who wants to be the governor, who said she was our friend. We had to embarrass her, but then she became our friend. And she intervened with the University of Maryland trustees, and they ceased their work till the laundry settled. And finally, the owner called up Mfume and said, "I will come and meet with the union." So we had a meeting on a Sunday morning in Mfume's office. And the owner said, "All right, I will sign a recognition of the union." We said, no. He said, "What do you mean no?" He said, "Now we don't trust you. We want a contract. We don't want recognition of the union because we don't want to negotiate with you. We want a contract, and here's what it has to have in it." He said, "Over my dead body." 2 weeks later, he signed that contract. 75-cent an hour pay increase, health care, dignity and respect for those workers, the reinstatement of every single one of those workers, and that guy's got religion. You would not believe him today. He's learned to say black. He's even learned to say Latino, which is absolutely unbelievable. And the fact is that not only did that campaign bring justice to the largest group of laundry workers in the city of Baltimore, but then following it up, as we speak, the second largest laundry, where we started an organizing campaign, the owner called up and said, "Uncle, I don't want this fight that you had with them. If the workers want a union, I'll sign the same contract," because they got religion. They got religion because we beat the hell out of up-to-date laundry. Fact is, our union believes once you engage in a fight with an employer on behalf of workers, that you got to win that fight, and we got to take tactics that just as vicious as the employer does. We don't believe in playing by the rules. We also don't believe in walking away from fights. We had a fight with an employer in Atlanta, Georgia, when my wife, who at that time was a union organizer, won an election at Bondo. If you know what Bondo is, if you don't have much money and you want to fix a dent in your car, instead of fixing it, you put Bondo in it and you paint it over. It's not, you won't admit it, but a lot of you know what Bondo is. And the one plant that makes Bondo in America is in Atlanta. My wife ran an election amongst those black workers, and we won that election by one vote in 1989. We took that four times to the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, and it took us 10 years for those 120 workers to get a union contract. Our union stuck with it. The workers got back wages. They now make $12 an hour, and Bondo is a union company. 10 years. The lawyer for the company said to me, "You people are crazy. You make bad business decisions." Well, he's right. Our union never makes good business decisions. Our decisions are moral. Our decisions are an employer takes on a group of workers. Our union fights to protect those workers. Our union is proud to say that when we engage in a fight, Bernstein & Sons Shirt Company, we won an election in Crystal Springs, Mississippi in 1973. We signed a contract in 1990. 17 years from winning the election to the contract. But those workers stuck together, and so did the union stick with it. And today, the Bernstein plant is the only union in Crystal Springs, Mississippi. In fact, it's the only thing in Crystal Springs, Mississippi. Fact is that our union's conducting a campaign now across the country on behalf of garment workers, aimed at the people that are causing the worldwide declining living standards for garment workers. The American apparel industry has been decimated. There are still 600,000 apparel workers, but 2 million apparel workers in other countries make apparel for the American economy. And the living standards of those workers, whether they're in Brooklyn or whether they're in Bangladesh, have been destroyed by the likes of retailers by reducing the prices that they pay for apparel. And the same companies like The Gap that say that they are monitoring the factories around the world. The Gap has 600 factories that produce for it. The Gap knows how many stitches per inch in every pair of jeans. They know exactly how every hem is made in a pair of their khaki pants. They know exactly where the buttons get placed on their shirts. Yet, and if a contractor makes one mistake, the Gap knows it and takes them off the list or returns the merchandise. Yet the Gap claims it does not know the conditions under which those apparel workers work. The fact is that the apparel industry worldwide is populated by children. It's populated by adults who don't earn a living. It's populated by prison labor in many countries. It's populated by poverty that it brings around the world. And the people responsible for that are the retailers. And so what our union has launched a few weeks ago is a campaign aimed at increasing the conditions, improving the conditions for apparel workers worldwide. And what we've done is we began with a demonstration in New York. That demonstration was unique, not because we had a demonstration against sweatshops. We targeted three retailers, Eddie Bauer, Ann Taylor, and the Gap Banana Republic. We could have targeted many more, but we targeted those three retailers, three particularly miserable specimens. And we targeted them to bring the attention to consumers about the conditions caused by the decisions of those companies as to what they will pay for that garment production, whether that garment production is in this country or another country. And we brought to bear not only the labor movement's pressure. I was there. We had 1,000 workers. We had Richard Trumka, the Secretary-Treasurer of the AFL-CIO. But for the first time, we had representatives of the religious community. We had the largest socially progressive Protestant denominations, ministers represented there. We had civil rights leaders. We had students, some of whom from Cornell, United Students Against Sweatshops, with us. We also had union leaders from the countries where that production is, from Thailand, from Hong Kong, from Nicaragua, from Dominican Republic, from Honduras, leaders of garment workers' unions in those countries where the workers actually do the production. And we called on the American consumers to vote with their dollars to improve conditions for garment workers worldwide. And we said that these retailers who are profiting off of this will understand only one thing, not moral suasion, not a bunch of legalisms, but they will understand consumer pressure. And we also picked out The Gap because The Gap not only is huge, it's a company headed by a guy named Drexler who is pulling in a living wage. Drexler is, had a bad year last year. He made $20 million. But that's because the company had a bad year. He'll get better, so don't take up any collections this afternoon for him. But the fact is that that company is an international disgrace. And we decided to target that company in particular because that company's focus is on its brand. You know, you don't buy Ralph Lauren at The Gap. The only products you buy at The Gap is The Gap. That's their label. That's their name. The one thing they have is that name. And their target are young people, people like folks in this room, high school students. And young people, we believe, have a sense of moral righteousness and are willing to vote with their consumer dollars about whether they support people as young as 12 years old working in garment factories. And we brought chapter and verse of what that company is doing. And that campaign is just the beginning, folks. We will make this an international issue, and we'll make it an issue to the retailers in the one way that they understand, which is to bring the spotlight of publicity on them. We will bring workers from their plants. We'll continue to bring them to the United States to testify. We will bring workers who have seen, as we saw a few weeks ago in Bangladesh, where 16 workers were killed with a false alarm in a garment factory because the doors were locked to keep the Bengali union organizers out of the factory. And 16 people were killed and there was no fire by the stampede of workers because the doors are locked and there's no fire escapes. We've seen worldwide conditions deteriorate, and the only way to stop it is to bring worldwide publicity on the backs of these, on the face of these people. Folks, the labor movement is capable of turning around and standing up to corporate power as no other force in society is. And not only low-wage workers, but the labor movement is signing up workers from doctors to university professors to, I hate to say it in these hallowed halls, gentlemen, but graduate students who are joining unions in unprecedented ways. You know, the labor movement, I've been a part of the labor movement since I graduated from this school. I've been privileged to have a job that I enjoy each and every day. There's nothing more exciting than to see an owner like that jerk at UpToDate be forced to look these Latino and black women in the eye and treat them with respect and dignity, be made to do something that he felt he was too powerful and rich and privileged to ever be made to do. Nothing more satisfying than seeing people get power that they never had before. The labor movement is an exciting opportunity for young people. I invite, you know, when I graduated from this school, most of America's unions were not open to idealistic college graduates. They thought we were radical. Some of you are. They thought that we were dangerous and thought that we were different. The fact of the matter is the American labor movement is more open to new ideas and idealism than ever before in its history. And I'm proud to say that my union and many others are recruiting dozens and dozens of idealistic young people that want to make a difference with their lives. You know, most of the people sitting in this room will wind up doing things other than trying to make society better, and that's your privilege and your decision. You'll do things that are perfectly legitimate jobs, most of you. And actually, you know, one of the things I'm proud about this school is you don't see the real bad guys come out of this school because I think there's a better set of values taught in this university. You don't see the real miserable lowlifes representing the management side come out of the Cornell ILR experience. But the fact of the matter is that you have choices to make at this point in your lives, whether you're graduate students, whether you're seniors, whether you're freshmen. The choice is to what's fulfilling in your life. And I can only relate this to you. Nothing has been more exciting to me than the path that I chose. It's rewarding. It's fun each and every day. Our union is full of idealistic people from my generation as well as recent university graduates who get off on fighting battles that other people think we can't win, who enjoy seeing the power balanced in American society, who enjoy seeing people achieve human dignity, respect, health care, opportunities for their children. When I see our local in Chinatown distribute scholarships to the sons and daughters of garment workers in Chinatown and see the pride on their parents' face that they have been able, through a union garment job, to send their kid to college, to me, that's what the labor movement is all about. It's certainly a fight that's winnable. Many of us are winning it. Those who want to signal the demise or the death of the American labor movement are way, way too premature. The labor movement has its imperfections, but the labor movement is alive and well. There's dynamic leadership. We're conducting the fight to save the guts of America. We're conducting the fight to save what's best about our country. And for the first time, we're welcoming droves of young people with college educations to bring the skills, bring your idealism, bring your energy, and be a part of it. For those of you who have several years to decide, I would urge you to do several things. One is participate. Take a shot at an anti-sweatshop demonstration. Take some time to do something for somebody else as opposed to do something for yourselves. Take the time to search out whether it might not be exciting for you to take part in a demonstration. You know, I've been, I'm not going to embarrass any of you to ask how many of you have been to jail, but I have had the privilege of being in jail many, many times, and always for a good cause. Fact is that the pride you feel in standing up for people that are fighting for human dignity and respect is unsurpassed. I see many people who go through crises later in life about what they've chosen to do, whether or not the newest version of the BMW is really what they set out to achieve in life. And some of you have, and God bless you, go get it. Others, I think there's more to it. And when I face my children and talk to them about values, I don't worry about what they think about what I do, because they see what I do. They see what I'm interested in. They see what I live my life doing. And everyone can't say that. And so what I urge you to do is take this opportunity while you're here to explore the labor movement, to explore social justice, to explore careers fighting for the people that don't have as much in society. You know, there's there are great men and great women who achieve many things in our society, from the political field to the religious field to the corporate field and the labor field. But there's no one that can top, in my opinion, standing for the people in our society that have no power, standing up for the hotel maids, standing up for the janitors, standing up for the garment workers, standing up for telephone operators, standing up for the people that do the work that Americans don't want to do and many times find invisible. We are a union that is on the move. We are a union that, despite tremendous adversity, continues. The last 2 years have achieved what I didn't know whether we could ever achieve, which is growth in our ranks. We're achieving growth not because apparel and textile jobs are not leaving the United States. We've achieved growth because of sheer effort to organize more workers than leave our plants. And we've seen more and more unions in America, folks, growing. And they're growing because of the efforts of tremendously dedicated people fighting battles that are not only exciting, but they're a hell of a lot of fun. You know, I don't know what it's like to sit in a corporate boardroom and decide to lay off the third shift. I'll bet it's a lot of laughs. I don't know what it's like to make a decision to merge two companies and destroy the livelihoods of 10,000 families. I don't want to know that. But I sure know what it's like to see the Bernstein and Son shirt workers after 17 years in Crystal Springs, Mississippi, look that boss in the eye and know that they have a union contract and a grievance procedure, and recognition as human beings. I know what it's like for those Latino laundry workers in New York to go to a first-class union health clinic instead of deny their children medical care. And that, to me, is thrilling and exciting, and I invite each and every one of you to take a look at whether that's not something you want to do with your life. This is a great school. You have a great opportunity. And I only urge you to use some of that intelligence, some of the gifts that this group has got. You're the elite intellects of society. You've got a unique opportunity at this school to make this society better, to make the world better for you and for your children. And by God, I hope many of you take advantage of it. Thank you very much.
That was Bruce Rayner, president of Unite, speaking at Cornell last August. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. Faith-based organizations in Tompkins County are playing an active role in the Tompkins County Coalition for a Living Wage. Faith-based organizations in Tompkins County are playing an active role in the Tompkins County Coalition for a Living Wage. Last August, local religious leaders gathered to urge greater involvement of their congregations in a community-based campaign for a living wage. Pete Myers of Catholic Charities is on the coalition's steering committee, and Anka Wessels is the director of the Center for Religion, Ethics, and Social Policy at Cornell. Here's some excerpts of their remarks.